All right, ladies and gentlemen, as some of you may recall from yesterday I had the good fortune to pay a tribute to H.P. Blavatsky and to try to discern in various ways and ultimately probably rather unsuccessfully as to who she was, because that is something that on this earth we will probably never know. However, I think we have gotten probably a picture at least of her activities, of her character, of the way she went about fulfilling her mission. And at that time, I mentioned, I think fairly early in the talk, that I consider her, and I'm certainly not the only one, as a representative of the esoteric tradition, as I will call it now, or the alternative reality tradition, which I called it, using the expression of Dame Frances Yates last time. And so I think what I propose to do now, but I have been known to depart radically from my course, sometimes to the delight and sometimes to the distress of my audience, so I can't promise anything on that. But what I propose to do is to recount within the context of HPB's teachings, first, what might be considered to be some of the principal features, as I see it, of the esoteric tradition. And then if there is any time left, I hope to make a few suggestions as to how the presentation and the practice of the esoteric tradition in the 21st century may be adjusted from the presentation that we received in the 19th century. So the possibilities of updating and things of that sort. So that's what I propose to do. Now, the esoteric tradition or the alternative reality tradition. First of all, just a tiny bit of historical background for it. In the so-called Western culture, which is really Mediterranean culture, it had its birth in the Mediterranean area, there existed powerful embodiments of the esoteric tradition at a very early time. The earliest times, of course, we have no records of, but let's say if we go back to the days of Plato and Pythagoras and all of these nice old boys to ancient Greece, and also associated with that to Rome and to Egypt and to Persia, and we find a particular magnificent feature of those cultures, which regrettably had eclipsed and then ceased to be, and that is the institution of the mysteries. And please, please, at least in my hearing, don't call them mystery schools. These were not schools. They didn't have little red schoolhouses in Eleusis, or in Alexandria. If we want to sort of coin some kind of expression of what they really were, laboratories of spiritual insight and transformation. Maybe a little bit like the alchemical laboratory much later by quite different means. Now, the magnificent circumstance relating to these was that they were not only tolerated, but they were established and supported by the secular governments in the Greek city-states and in the other countries that I have mentioned. And they were a regular, established, known, and highly extolled and regarded features of society. The esoteric tradition very often did not possess those kinds of privileges, but rather different ones, such as being persecuted, thrown into dungeons, burnt at the stake, and in various ways maltreated because of its practices and because of its beliefs. But in the true ancient world, that was the case. These mysteries were open to pretty much everyone. In Greece, the Eleusinian mysteries and the, were open to everyone who was not a murderer. And maybe even there they could talk their way out of it. Well, you know, his moussaka was so bad when he ran that restaurant that I just had to hit him and he died, you know, whatever. Anyway, so they were very egalitarian in terms of their admissions. They admitted men and women, and what went on in their precincts in detail, in terms of the actual circumstances, the words being spoken, the deeds being performed, for the most part, we have very little of any knowledge. Why? Because they were secret. And you wonder, well, you know, this secrecy business. I mean, the people go around, the Freemasons, we heard about that yesterday, and all that, and they so go around and say, I've got a secret, which is really not what they do, you know. That. But what we need to keep in mind is that a real secret is a secret because there is no way of conveying it. There is no way of talking about it. There is no way of telling anybody else about it. And you say, well, what kind of a crazy experience must that be? Well, that's exactly it. It's a very different experience. It may not be crazy, but it's very different from what you are used to. And its results are that you are changed. Changed in a good way, which is seldom happens in this world. You know, we are so change, we want change, we're going to vote for change, this and that. And then if there is any change at all, it's usually a change for the worse. I mean, I have seen a lot of changes with my, until I got this hair, white like this, and very few of those changes are ones that I like. Now, maybe that's personal to me, but I don't. However, let's say this is something entirely different. Well, just one little example that we have, and which I think is pretty momentous. And this was, I think it was written down at least as a personal testimony by Cicero, who was a lawyer and a very persnickety and critical old guy. And he said that everyone who went through the Eleusinian mysteries had totally and forever lost his fear of death. Now, you know, when you can do that, then you're really doing something. And they did. And so they were really what you might say, they were places of spiritual transformation that opened up avenues of consciousness, as we would call it nowadays, replete with insight and inspiration and strength and power of a nature that prior to the mystery experience was not available to them. And so this was a very, very important issue. This was the spiritualizing, the transforming core of the ancient world. And from a certain time on, no matter where you were, for instance, in the Mediterranean area, you could find such institutions and you could be admitted to them. And so for a long time, I think at least one of the stories is that the Eleusinian mysteries, which are the best known, based on the mythos of Persephone and Demeter, that the Eleusinian mysteries probably functioned for about 5,000 years. Now, this may be an exaggeration, but it's considerable length of time. Anything that endures for 5,000 years is probably offering something pretty good. Otherwise, people would not go to it. In any event, these were the spiritual institutions of transformation and insight for a long time. But as time changes, often the very best establishments that human mind had created begin to decline, and they no longer have the power, they no longer have the know-how, they no longer have the appeal, and then, well, they go out of business. And that is, of course, what happened. So when we come now to the Christian era, to you astrologers, the Piscean Age, the mysteries were declining, but something else was coming up, which took the place of the mysteries. And these were spiritual schools, I'll have to get out the cat of nine tails and punish myself when I go back to the room, you know. Ancient, painful custom. But in any event, they were associations of people, sometimes formal and sometimes not so formal, wherein the work that was previously done by the mysteries was now performed. And we know of at least three major ones of these. And these were the Neoplatonists, the Hermeticists, and my old friends, the Gnostics. And owing to various circumstances that don't really concern us, they were all to a major extent centered in Alexandria, the city that Alexander the Great founded in Egypt, and whereas Carl Jung or his inspirer wrote in the Seven Sermons to the Dead, and if you don't know what that is, then pick up my book, The Gnostic Jung. I'll even sign it for you. What the heck? The city where East and West meet. So this was, while Rome was the political center of the Roman Empire, Alexandria was the spiritual center. Now, even on first glance, that should mean something to us of the theosophical tradition, because after all, where does the term theosophy originate? You know, here were these darling people, real band of eccentrics and strange people in New York City, in that house where my good friend Michael Gomes chose to live in New York, when he founded the Theosophical Society. There they were together, and they came up with this name, the Theosophical Society. I'm sure that Colonel Olcott didn't learn that in Hartford, Connecticut, where he came from. You know, my friends tell me there is still a street in Hartford named after the Olcott family. So if you go there, you'll be sure to see Olcott Street. I think it's street, yeah. So in any event, you know, it's not the sort of thing that you think of just sort of off the top of your head. But it is a term that was coined by the man who is credited with being the founder of the Neoplatonic school, Ammonius Saccas, a fabulous character in his own right. But let us say what he started, and he's like one of these mystics, and there are always some. They're certainly in the Kabbalistic tradition, we find a whole bunch of them, Isaac Luria, even the great Kabbalistic heretics. They never wrote a line in their life, but there was a disciple was there who wrote it down. And so similarly, Ammonius didn't write anything, but he inspired a tremendous number of people with his incredible mystical talks. And then afterwards, along came the disciples, probably the best known one, although not that much my favorite, Plotinus, Iamblichus, Porphyrius, and there is one more whom I can think about, as Dr. Suzuki was wont to say, look it up in the book. In any event, you know, a whole number of teachers, and and to make this short, their ostensible approach to the teaching and the practice of the transformation of the human soul was, according to their statements, and they were pretty truthful about it, based on the inner teachings of the great Plato. That's what they were called, the New Platonists and Neoplatonists. All right. There were the Hermeticists, who pursued the same goal, but they were for the most part Egyptians, although by that time Hellenized Egyptians, who regarded as their, I think it's John Algio who corrected me on that score once here in this very room. God bless him. Wonderful, wonderful friend. I remember him, right, walking around in this room some years ago. In any event, John Algio corrected me. He says Hermes was the psychopomp. Now, you usually think the psychopomp is somebody who guides the souls around so they are not going to fall into the river Styx or something of that sort. But it's a guide of souls. So Hermes was the symbolic guide of souls. Unlike the Neoplatonists, who were the teachers were forthright enough to sign their own names to their writings, the Hermeticists, everything, all the Hermetic books, and there are a lot of them, wonderful stuff, were all attributed to Hermes. Hermes wrote all the books, although no doubt somebody else wrote them down. And the Hermeticists were a little more, I don't know, how should I put it, technical about the process of transformation and its origins, even as were the Gnostics, because they said that we suffered, and I got to make this fast now, that we suffered spiritually the fate of Narcissus. Now, you know maybe a little bit the story of dear Narcissus. He was a very nice-looking young man. He would be very popular in San Francisco and possibly even in West Hollywood and so forth. And he looked into a well, into a body of water, and he saw his own image there, which he did not recognize as his own image. And he said, oh, there is a nice-looking guy. I'm lonesome, and there's a nice-looking guy there. So he jumped into the well. And then he came out on the other end, and he ended up in this world. And you know what? He couldn't get back. He was caught. He didn't like it very much. So eventually he turned into a Narcissus flower. So when you pick up a Narcissus, think of dear Narcissus, that he might be around there still longing to somehow get back above that well. Now, the whole meaning behind this being that we have come from a different place, one that apparently we liked, and then we have gotten caught in another place which is sort of dicey and difficult in various ways. If that circumstance has escaped you until now, then you still got a little bit of living to do, you know. But certainly, and so, you know, there is, but even though we are here on the other side of the well, we can do various things. We can be guided by the mysterious psychopompic power of Hermes and others, and explore. We can first explore the physical world, then we can explore the emotional world, then we can explore the intellectual world, and then we can explore the other worlds beyond that. To say the least, we can have a royal good time doing that, because there's so much interesting, so many interesting things there. And eventually, we will have had experiences, we will have had assimilated various spiritual powers, and then we can get back to our original home, Hermeticism. People didn't know a doggone thing about it until about the time of the Renaissance, where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the Hermetic books, many of them, were discovered. Well, they were hidden away somewhere in Constantinople or around there. you know, Constantinople is now is Istanbul, you know, that sort of thing, and you don't want to go there now. It's pretty bad. In any event, the Turks were coming then also, and so somebody brought the books back to Italy. And the Medici princes, who by that time were very rich and very interested in all kinds of things, said, this stuff has got to be translated right now from the Greek and possibly from the Coptic. And so the great translators went to work, and the Hermetic books were all there. And they are still available to us. Very wonderful literature. All right, the third one, the Gnostics. Well, these were, let's say, their basic approach was rather similar to that of the Hermeticists. They also said, we are here, we are caught, we are separated from our original condition, and we have to do various things to remedy that situation so that we can reconnect with our origins, reconnect with the divine. But they were, at least originally, mostly of the Hebraic tradition. They were Jews, the first one having been Simon Magus, to whom Madame Blavatsky in the new esoteric teachings book that Michael Gomes had just published has a huge amount of pages about Simon Magus, and then a whole bunch of other people. Jews, Greeks, Egyptians, you name it. And both the Hermeticists and the Gnostics, their word, their concept for the process of liberation, enlightenment, was Gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. In German, we still call it Gnosis, but it's hard for people to pronounce here, so don't try. You know. In any event, now these three were the successors of the mysteries, because what they tried to accomplish was the same thing as the mysteries. These three became the fountainhead of the esoteric tradition. So wherever you look from then on, from the 3rd, 4th century onwards, because these flourished maybe 100 or 2 years BC and then until about 400 AD, you will find that in some manner the tradition goes back to this three-leaf clover of alternative mysticism. However, now I have to put in a caveat. This all sounds, at least up to a point, as what is tradition? You know, it comes from the Latin tradere, which means handing on. The word trade comes from the same word, because you hand on something and then hopefully they hand back some money to you, you know, trading. Handing on. So that, you know, dear old Tevye, I mean, he's the one who knew all about it. Tradition. However, we have to be careful. Because it's not just something that is handed on from one teacher to another, or one group of people to another. That's part of it. But it is also, if you just, very, very easy thing to visualize, you visualize the design of a cross, then you can say that the handing on of tradition is like the horizontal line. It goes on and on. One teacher hands it over to another, and it keeps going. But you know what, when that is all that is taking place, then things are very, very incomplete. There is a vertical line. And that vertical line is what? Is what comes into the tradition from out of this world, from the other realms, from the mystery, whatever you want to call it. And so there is, let's say, the sort of objective part of the tradition, but also the mysterious part of the tradition. When these two come together, that point at the center of the cross, that is a really valid and active tradition. And the esoteric tradition, for the most part, attempted to do that. And One of the other ways in which you can, which is really very important for our purposes too, is that this is from Plotinus, after all, you know, I still like him. Maybe not as much as Iamblichus, some of the others, but still. So Plotinus said that in order to have a valid situation, a valid mystery, a valid tradition, you have to have two things, and they are called in Greek theoria and theurgia. Theoria is from which we get the English word theory, you know, and theurgia, however, is the divine work. How to invoke the gods, how to enter into an intimate relationship with the mystery that is beyond the veil of physicality, and not only physicality, but intellectuality also. And don't make a face and get mad at me, because you know, you can quote and I can quote H.P.B. who said, "The mind is the slayer of the real." Very important thing to remember. And then, but fortunately, we have something within ourselves that she called the self. Theosophists often call the higher self. Carl Jung calls it the self with a capital S. Let the self slay the slayer. Now, you don't really want to slay your mind, because then you're going to be a mindless creature, and mindless creatures are not terribly useful or terribly attractive. You know, you don't want to do that. There are even practices that people consider spiritual that kind of cause what in French we call abaissement du niveau mental, a going down of the mental niveau rather than higher. Carl Jung was making fun of the cults of his day, even said there is such a thing in the German world as Verdummungs-Yoga, which is the yoga of becoming stupid. So now you got to keep that in mind. That's not a yoga you want to go to. In any event, finishing this off, all throughout history now, this tradition went on, the historical trajectory, and every time there were great and unusual people within the tradition who managed to establish the vertical arm, because they had their own inspiration, they had their own insight, they had their own contact with that ineffable mystery which is beyond the world of the senses and of the intellect. It kept on going. But unfortunately, from a certain time onward, in Western culture, and this was really Christianity's great fault, the esoteric tradition, not entirely, but for the most part, was suppressed. Sometimes it was more suppressed than other times, but it was there. So the esoteric tradition had a hard time in the Western world for a very long period. It would erupt again and again. Somebody called it as it's like an underground stream of water, which you can see some of those things in Arizona and so forth. It runs under the ground, and you can, oh, well, there must be something there. So here you are in this barren desert, but there's a line, and there are trees, and there's grass along it. You know, what's going on? Well, there is the one water is underneath. It was like an underground stream that way, that still nourished this alternative approach to spirituality, which was not concentrated on the monotheistic image, which didn't say that if you behave according to a particular set of commandments, you're going to go to heaven, and if you slip up at all, then down below, deep down below, there is a place for you to go. You know? The esoteric tradition didn't see these things. The esoteric tradition said some of the things that I'm going to try to outline to you. No, you thought I'm never going to get around to it, but I did. It's okay. And let's see, the first and to me probably the most urgent disclosure of the esoteric tradition is that there is a spiritual spark. The Greek called it the pneuma, the spirit, which sleeps inside of us. A spiritual essence within the human, and fortunately, it's not only always sleeping. The Gnostics would say the demiurgs, sort of the nasty angels, gave the pneuma a very heavy sleeping pill. You know, so it's, but it can be awakened. It has the potential of awakening. Now, maybe I'm just a little bit too single-minded in this respect, but I think this is the all-important, maybe the only important, really only important disclosure of the esoteric tradition. It's more important than reincarnation. It's more important than karma. It's more important than the existence of angels or of masters or of anything in this world or in the other worlds. Because if this is not true, then, you know, all the stuff that we are studying, all the things that we are doing are totally in vain. Because what's going to happen? Why in the heck are we reincarnating? Or maybe you are. I'm determined I'm not coming anymore. Sorry. If you, after a while, if you want to see me, you're going to go elsewhere. You know. But let's say, why? Why? Oh, well, we are evolving, which is another problem, that problem of evolution. You know. But the issue is, there's something there. It's right there in the stanzas of Zan, the spark that came from the flame. And if I recall correctly, you know, said the flame to the spark, "Thou art myself. I have clothed myself in thee." So the spark, whatever else you want to call it, it's not just the creation. It's not just something that was made. It's not just something that the old Hebraic carpenter Jehovah somehow chiseled out and said, "Hey, here's the man. Here's the man. Oh, look at him." Oh, well, an afterthought. There's the woman. You know, none of these things. But it is identical with the ultimate heart of all being. It is the ultimate reality dwells within you. In miniature, it's not very active. It's sleepy. That sleeping pill is still effective in most of us, at least to some extent. But it can awaken. And to help it awaken, the esoteric tradition exists. If that is not true, as I say, then everything else pales into total hopeless and helpless insignificance. And now this is something, of course, that just like in the stanzas of Zan, it can't be otherwise. It runs all through HPB's writings, all of her disclosures, all of her sayings. One of her saying that sort of stuck in my mind, but also because I was reminded of it by a particular teacher of mine, in Isis Unveiled, somewhere, I leave it up to Michael Gomes or somebody to find it. You know, he finds everything. But you really have to motivate him, you know. You got to be nice to him and give him something, whatever. Right, Michael? But, you know, it's a saying, never for a moment lose sight of your divine and immortal soul. Now, of course, you can observe about that. Well, yes, HPB, I don't want to lose sight of it, but I never caught sight of it to begin with. Where is it? In which case, I think the old lady would stamp out her cigarette and she would say, "Well, then go ahead and do it. Catch sight of it, will you?" And it's true. So this is the center of the hub. This is the center of the wheel of the of the great chakra. And if that center is not there, then really nothing else of great worth is there. But it was, you know, it is definitely an extremely important issue. But now, of course, arises quite legitimately the question as to how one makes contact with the sleeping one, and then how one tries to coax the sleeping one into wakefulness. And it's a pretty big task. And the Greeks, of course, who are the ancestors of much of this, they would say, well, do a little bit like the Eleusinian mysteries, but of course that's a complex issue, and I say most of it remains secret, which is also a heck of a big thing to do. I mean, to get a bunch of Greeks to stay quiet about something that long, that in itself is a tremendous fault, because as you know, the Greek DNA is filled with loquacity, and I certainly don't mean that as a put down, but the Greeks would say, well, look at let's say the Eleusinian mysteries. What was there? There was a myth. There was the myth of Persephone, the daughter, and of Demeter, the mother, and how Persephone is caught by the Lord of the Underworld, and how the mother goes after finding her then, and all that goes on, and finally an arrangement is reached. And so this is also something that the esoteric tradition always cultivated. Wherever you look, whichever historical period when the esoteric tradition is, each manifestation of the tradition had its myth. Now, you may not have recognized it as a myth right away. Alchemy, the alchemical transformation, well, of course, there is a strong theurgia, a strong practical aspect of it, but it is a myth. Now, of course, some of you may have been indoctrinated by newspapers and other horrible things, saying that a myth is a lie. A myth is something that isn't true. A myth is truer than physical truth. A myth is even more true than intellectual truth. And maybe with our motto that HPB and Colonel, you know, they took it, I believe, from the Michael will either beat me up afterwards or agree with me. I think they took it from the Maharaja of Benares, or Satya Nasti Parodharma. My Sanskrit is bad. But you see that there is no dharma higher than truth. Now, what is that truth? Is it a teaching? Is it a doctrine? Is it a set of commandments, of rules? No! What is it? It is the authenticity of being. It is the reality of the truth beyond earthly truth. And one of the main manifestations is that little truth, of course, that resides within us. But that truth has been expressed throughout the ages, in India by the Puranas, in Tibet by various myths, in the West initially by the Greeks and so forth, in mythic form. And we are, and as I said, every manifestation of the esoteric tradition has its myth. And that myth, again, it's not an intellectual thing, but it's something that is trying to tell you something ineffable that cannot be told really effectively in any other way. We mentioned Freemasonry a while ago. There is the myth of Hiram and various other things. Everywhere there is a myth. The Christian religion, there is the myth of Jesus Christ primarily and others. And these are not falsehoods, but they are a tale told about mysterious things which you cannot really effectively convey in any other way. HPB knew this. There are all kinds of quotations, and I don't think I should take time up by quoting, because you can find those quotations yourself. After all, you can just pick up the Secret Doctrine and read the whole thing again. You'll find the quotation. It's so easy, you know, so easy. Of course, Michael made it somewhat easier with the shorter version, but you know, it's all over her. She certainly understood the value of this. And she says in Isis, for instance, that myth was the favorite and universal method of teaching the truth in archaic times. And I think it's also still true today. And then see, just another one also from Isis. Myths are now found by so many people to be fables, just in proportion as we misunderstand them, truths in proportion as they were once understood. I think that tells enough. And I think, again, we are blessed by various things that happened in recent decades, and one of them being that there has arisen in the 20th century a much more insightful and helpful school of the study of mythology. It was inspired by Carl Jung. It was carried forward in our country by that marvelous gentleman, Joseph Campbell. But also by my countryman, Carl Carini, and a number of other people, Mircea Eliade of the University of Chicago. And all of these approaches to myth that came to us in the first and second half of the 20th century have recognized that the myth is not just a story. It is not something that is untrue, but that is something that is trying to convey truths and mysteries which cannot be conveyed, at least not that effectively, by any other means. The Greeks knew that. That's why they were so fond of their myths. And so that is certainly a great advantage that we have. And when we look at, say, the Hermetic writings, which have been available more or less ever since the time of the Renaissance, and if we look at the Gnostic writings, which became available in the latter part of the 20th century, we see that the overwhelming majority of them are in mythic form. And if we read these and read them with the eagerness of our higher faculties, we are thereby stimulated in certain ways, and that sleeping little spark within us begins to glow, begins to glow. And as we add, let's say, the spiritual air to it, it grows into a flame, and eventually it burns up all the dross, all the undesirable things, it comes into its own, until in good time it grows into a mighty flame and it shoots up into the sky and beyond the sky to the fullness of the divine from whence it came and whither it is bound to return. So Joy Mills said several times in my hearing in Crotona, which for the last number of years was the place where I always saw her and heard her, she said, oh yes, you know, the Secret Doctrine is a myth. And I saw some of the people in the audience, Joy Mills says that, oh my gosh, you know, the world is coming to an end. Well, sometimes one wishes that it did. You know. However, you know, Joy Mills, you know, many of you know Joy Mills better than I do. But Joy Mills didn't say things like that fortuitously or randomly. She knew what she was talking about. And they said, well, isn't it true that there was an Atlantis? You know what? Maybe it's true, maybe it ain't true, if you don't mind me using the vernacular. It doesn't make any difference. But you know what? There is an Atlantis in us. a sunken continent, that which is underneath the waters of time and of what psychology would call the waters of the unconscious. And if you listen to your psyche, if you listen to your soul, you hear the bells under the waters, the bells of Atlantis. He says, yes, here I am, here I am. And he, now, isn't that a more inspiring way of looking at it than going as, you know, some of the, our new age friends were doing? You know, I know a whole boatload of them from Southern California. They were going to find Atlantis, and they went. Where the heck did they go first? Yeah, they went, I think, first off the coast of Spain. Which would, you know, the Pillars of Hercules and all that sort of thing. Well, the redoubtable Caudillo, Francisco Franco Bahamonde, was still in power. He didn't want these American New Agers swimming around. They said, get the heck out of here. So they went. And then they went over way up somewhere north around the coast of Ireland, and they were looking for Atlantis there. So was it here, was it there, or was it nowhere? I mean, you know, it's just like if I don't find it here, I go across the world and find it someplace else. Well, in a way, that's true. It's mythically true because you have to find it within yourself. So, you know, so if we take a more mythic view of so many of the items, say, in the secret doctrine elsewhere, it doesn't mean that we are reducing them to a falsehood. Because most myths have some physical basis too, but that's not the important thing. You know, we as total beings, we have a physical basis. It's our body. But I think the almost any theosophist will be the first one to tell you that that's just a small portion. You know, that's not where it's at, as they put it in recent years. And same way, the physical side of the secret doctrine and other things, well, much of it may be there. It's not really the truly important side. However, let me move on a little. Another point of convergence is, and I'll just spend very little time on that, is the God concept of the Judeo-Christian-Islamic family of religions, as against the God concept, the divine concept. And I start with them, the Gnostics, the Hermeticists, the Neoplatonists, and I trust the Theosophists. Now, there is almost no teaching that Madame Blavatsky excoriated more vehemently and more frequently than the monotheistic God. She said the most astonishingly nasty things about Jehovah that you ever want to or don't want to hear. She was more vehement than Carl Jung in his book Answer to Job, and that's pretty vehement right there. I mean, you know, people left Dr. Jung's company in droves because of that, you know. Now, why did she do that? I mean, you know, she used the entirety of her extensive pejorative vocabulary to blast the monotheistic God. There's a reason for that. Why? Because this, in what Jung would call this gravely flawed and inadequate God image, has been an affliction of the Judeo-Christian Islamic world. And she knew that. And she, not only did she know it, but she didn't mind telling it as she saw it. And she sure as heck told it, you know. The old Gnostics, my friends, were accused of, you know, saying nasty things about Jehovah. They are mild compared to H.P. Blavatsky. Oh boy, did she let the old God do it, or have it rather. Now you say, well, what's the good of that? Why should you engage in what the majority of the people consider blasphemy in your well? Because she knew, and she was trying to convey there's something radically wrong with this God. Now, there are a few things that are right, too. Not too many. But there's a lot of things that are really wrong. And moreover, there's a lot of things wrong with what he's supposed to have created. Again, there are a lot of things that are nice, but certainly not all. And so she undoubtedly felt, according to many, many statements, that one of the things that needs to change in the world is what C.G. Jung called the God image, namely the manner in which we conceptually and emotionally and intuitively approach the divine. And what has been given to us to approach is no good. I'm not channeling HPB. Give me a cigarette, will you? No, we can't. No, we can't do it. You know, even if HPB came, she couldn't smoke it here. All right, that's fine. I don't smoke cigarettes anymore either. But that doesn't mean, you know, a good cigar I will not turn down. Sorry to make all these self-disclosures. They sound very egotistical. But let's say, you know, it's HPB who said it over and over again. You don't even have to read between the lines. What is wrong with Christianity, with Judaism, and with Islam is the image of the God, of their God. Now, what's happening now? Actually, there has been, I think, a lot of pulling away in many previously Christian countries from that God image. Religion in the Western culture has been waning. And much of that is due to the God image and to various things associated with it. But of course, you know, we always do things wrong. That's how humans are. And of course, what we do is we just say, you know, this God they've been telling us about, he's just no good. And so we declare that there is no God. We don't want any. To heck with it. Or even anything divine. Now, you know, I understand that. And perhaps a lot of people have to go through that stage of denial before they discover maybe a new one, or a better one, or something of that sort. But it's also dangerous. Don't think it's not dangerous. Chesterton, who of course was a Catholic propagandist, but who still was a very, very smart Englishman, said, when people cease to believe in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. And you know, this has to be kept in mind. Even though I was a kid, I saw that happen. That's what led to the Nazis. That's what led to the communists. That's what led to World War II. Because, you know, a situation somewhat similar to what is going on now existed between the two world wars. And there too, not as many people as now, but sort of the normative people of European society, for instance, didn't believe in any religion anymore. They looked down on religion. So what did they get? They get a cruel, idiotic, imbecilic, secular religion called National Socialism, with its God, a little ugly man with a horrible little mustache, who didn't even speak German in a very cultured fashion, but who spoke like a vulgar Austrian. And I lived in Austria, so I know what that is. And in the same way, in Russia and things, an other horrible guy with a great big mustache, you know, and all that. We got to watch out. I mean, things can happen that could be very deleterious because of the way we go about pulling away from that God image. All right, here we are, theosophists and other weird people. Wouldn't it be correct for us to try to employ ourselves in the direction of offering viable and authentic, spiritually authentic alternatives to the previous God image. Don't we have material to that effect? And if we don't have it in our books, we have it in ourselves. Because that, you know, that spark. So we should employ ourselves in that direction. Very, very important. We and others like us, hopefully not too much like us. I don't think the world could stand too many people like us, you know. It would crack apart. But let's see, people and other people along our own lines, this is a very, very important, urgent task of this moment. People talk about saving the planet and changing the climate. You know what? If we don't save our souls and the souls of our fellow beings in this sense of being able to relate to the divine being, then all the other things are not going to amount to anything. This is again, this previously I mentioned, you know, the God inside is, but this is again, it is a task of incredible urgency. And if we can see that, well, then too bad for those who can't see it. But it is very, very urgent. Now, fortunately, of course, and I'll come to that in another minute. Fortunately, there are possible indications, and where one has to be tentative about this thing, there are possible indications that something is sort of developing, coming. HPB said it. I don't have the quotation with me, but I have it back home. In our contemporary times, particularly in the famous Red Book, C.G. Jung said it. Others have said it. They said it that a new aeon, as Jung called it, is coming. And is this new aeon will have a new God image. But on the way to it, there is a lot of difficulty and a lot of dislocation that we go through. Now, you know, I don't like prophecies. Why? Because, let's see, who was that? Yogi Berra, the great prophet, great figure of our culture, said that, how did he say it? That foretelling is difficult, especially about the future. So, you know, it is. And so when one gets into that, it's a very, very dicey thing. But on the other hand, over the ages, especially in the esoteric tradition, there have been a lot of pointers in this direction. And so it's quite possible that HPB and others were alluding to something that is really going to happen and trying to happen. But there again, we need to inject something. HPB perhaps didn't say that, although she could have. Carl Jung said it, and others have said it, that the best way to move into these newer developments and toward the new God image is to take with us the valuable part, the good part, the treasure of the previous religious matrix. Because that's the best. If we discard everything, then we have to start from scratch. And are we really that smart that we can start completely from scratch? You know, I don't think so. And so this is probably the reason for, or at least one of the reasons, for one of the objects of the Theosophical Society, namely the comparative study of religion and then other disciplines. Why? Because when we study comparatively the various religions, then we can see the God image, and we can see the treasures that they have brought. And they also have brought a lot of trash. It's not up to us to criticize the trash in other religions, but there sure is a heck of a lot of it in Christianity. And as a lifelong Christian, and I can testify to that. But, you know, the trash does not invalidate the good. And here is, I can just suggest to you what the good is, and many of you are not going to agree. What I suggest is going back a little bit to the terminology of old Plotinus, the theology of Christianity may be riddled with balderdash, or if you don't like that term, with flapdoodle, that HPB would like that better. It's full of nonsense. There are some good things there, but really, believe you me, I had to study it a lot. It's full of nonsense. But the theurgia, what is the theurgia? The theurgia are the sacraments. The theurgia is the Eucharist, which in the Gnostic heretical scripture in the Gospel of Philip, it comes forth and says, the Lord did everything in a mystery, and then they go through a baptism and a chrism and the Eucharist and the redemption and the bride chamber. So there, the practice has not been bad. The practice is archetypal, as Jung would call it. And perhaps that is what we need to get hold of and save into the next aeon so that it will be there. Because we should not allow the useful, the good, the helpful to be destroyed because of the bad part. I would suggest that with our study, especially in our study of religion and things of that sort, that we get hold of the good things, and probably not only of Christendom, but there is a religion, so I understand, I haven't been now in other culture for a long, long time, but it may be in... there are religious problems in elsewhere. In Islam, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, everywhere there are problems. There too, let's try to get hold, and particularly the practitioner, get hold of the good part and start discarding the bad part. And then we can take the treasure, the pearl of great price, and take it throughout the ages and bring it to the new aeon and to the new image and offer it up. Here it is. Because if we discard everything, the chances are that we will be in culturally and individually in a very bad shape. So the time is started a little late. The time is now up. Let me conclude by saying that much of the treasure is in our theosophical tradition, in our theosophical teachings. But you also are bound to admit, unless you want to admit it, which is always our option, that we have a heck of a lot of theoria and very little theurgia in our theosophy. Now, there are good reasons for that, because this all was first enunciated in the 19th century, where the theurgy, shall we say, the sacrament, the transcendental magic, was regarded by the intellectual classes as, a good Victorian term for it, mere mumbo jumbo. Mumbo jumbo. Well, I think we got to look at the mumbo jumbo and see what it is useful there. And we should not allow the theoretical, the intellectual, or even the political to occupy us too much and swallow up our energy, which we need for the discovery of what we have received and its guarding and taking it over into the future. And I think we can do it. This is not it is not a criticism of our theosophical framework. Blavatsky did the best that she could. Michael said, you know, yesterday she tried and tried and tried to get a bunch of people together who could do some of this theurgy and practice things that would allow them to awaken the spark within them. She started an esoteric school, then later on she started the inner group. You know, she tried and tried, and she said to people, I have tried, but you know, I didn't really succeed, not with that. Well, listen, all that work of theory and otherwise, it was too much for a poor, sick Russian lady. She couldn't do it all. But maybe, this long time after, maybe we can do some of it, you know? And I have a feeling, I don't know where she is, and if she is somewhere even accessible, I don't think she would talk to me, you know? Russians and Hungarians don't get along all that well, you know? But I think she would be pleased by this kind of an endeavor, you know? Look for that. Don't be taken in by what is going on in the culture, whether it is atheism, whether it is a number of other things, whether it's all these politicized things that are going on. We theosophists don't have to save the planet. We theosophists don't have to change the climate. If there is any of you who knows how to change the climate, please contact me afterwards, and I'll find you a good job somewhere, you know. But we can, and we should, and we have been called to discover what can help the awakening, the growth, and the flaming up of that marvelous spark that is within us. That is the central task. There are ancillary tasks, sure, but that is the central task. It has always been the central task. It has been that in Eleusis, it has been that in Palestine, it has been that in Alexandria, and it is still the same today in Chicago and in Los Angeles and elsewhere. So maybe, good friends, you might be a little bit motivated in that regard. Maybe this has given you a little something to feel about and to think about and intuit about, so that we may address ourselves increasingly to that great task. And I think the greatness of being and its representatives, including that messenger of light whom the world knew as H.P. Blavatsky, would be and will be pleased and happy, and they will bless you as they should, and we will receive blessings and help abundant if we address ourselves to the real, to the great, to the greatest task. So I thank you abundantly, and I'm very glad that we were able to do this, and adios, as we say in California.